Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the ways that science is being silenced and to what end? But first, how propaganda works, particularly in democratic settings. With us is Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know How, and How Propaganda Works. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley. It's great to have you here. Your new book, How Propaganda Works, you do a real philosophical look at this and a bit of a historic look, especially through modern history, and I think that's really important. Before we started recording, we were talking about how even appointments can serve as a means of propaganda. What have you observed?
Well, I think if you look at some of the appointments that our president-elect has made to various departments, and you can see that he has a strong tendency, as Saturday Night Live has noted, to appoint people who, to serve the mission of those departments who don't believe in that mission. For instance, Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who said that he was going to eliminate the Department of Energy, is the nominee for the Department of Energy. And Scott Pruitt, who is a environmental, he now concedes that there's man-made human-caused climate change, but he's generally a climate change skeptic, looks like he's going to be the head of the EPA, and then all down the road. This doesn't hold true for every appointment, but for example, Betsy DeVos, who is going to be Secretary of Education, it looks like, and she's been a strong figure arguing essentially against public education. So what the president-elect is doing is he's appointing the main enemies of various tasks as the people who will run those tasks for the federal government.
And so how does this fit in with propaganda itself?
Well, I characterize a notion of propaganda I call undermining propaganda in my book, which is the propaganda, kind of propaganda one finds characteristically in liberal democratic societies, officially liberal democratic societies like our own in the United States. And undermining propaganda works by taking a cherished ideal, to say education or the environment, and then using it as a way to undermine the realization of that very ideal. So if you have someone who doesn't believe in human-caused climate change tasked to run our nation's policies for the environment, then what you're going to find is that person saying this is good for the environment, but in fact their actions will undermine what is good for the environment. So under the guise of the department or cabinet position itself, which gives one cover, after all, the Secretary of Education is supposed to stand up for public education, it's supposed to stand up for the ideals of public education, that can give, for example, DeVos cover to undermine those very goals.
It sounds like a classic 1984 sort of war is peace approach.
Right. For example, the Guantanamo Bay prison is called Camp Justice.
Right.
So this didn't start now. Operation Iraqi Freedom is a salient other example.
And I think we saw that in the Bush administration quite a bit with the so-called Clean Skies Act and No Child Left Behind and those types of phrases that were not really attempting to bring across those missions.
They were really doing the reverse, weren't they?
You looked at the actual regulations of, say, the Clean Skies Act, they were being dismantled. So you would think, yes.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So that's another paradigm example.
Right.
You name things the opposite of what they actually do. And that's undermining propaganda in my sense. And I really think we need a narrower characterization of propaganda than the one that ordinarily comes to mind, which is cherry picking, producing an argument from one perspective, because that's too general. Then every argument, especially in politics, is propaganda. And that's too general of a characterization for such a nefarious and dangerous political strategy.
Let's look at your definition of propaganda. How are you defining it in this new book?
So I go through different definitions of propaganda in the second chapter, and I argue that the classical definitions in terms of bias and cherry picking are too general because virtually everything counts as propaganda. I mean, each word shades things in a certain way. So if I call someone a professor, that will raise certain connotations in the hearer's mind and hence bias the discourse. So almost every word has that kind of feature where it brings with it connotations that slightly slant the discourse. They don't make the discourse non-factual or inventing reality. They just sort of bias it slightly. If somebody says professor, this professor said, then if they're talking to one kind of audience, that might give that source a very negative casting. And another audience, it might give that source a positive casting. But that's extraneous to the information being delivered. So I think that propaganda as speech that biases a conversation is too general. So I focus on a narrower characterization. I have two categories of propaganda. One I call supporting propaganda. And supporting propaganda is the kind of propaganda we find most characteristically in authoritarian societies. And unsurprisingly, you find authoritarians such as Goebbels or Hitler, when they describe propaganda, focusing on supporting propaganda. Supporting propaganda is propaganda that shuts off rational thought. It overwhelms rational thought with, as Klemperer calls them, emotions detached from their ideas. The idea here is not to draw a distinction between rationality and emotion. Emotions can be perfectly rational. It's perfectly rational to be fearful at certain times in history. It's perfectly rational to be fearful when you see a snake or something like that. Those are rational emotions. But supporting propaganda takes sort of accentuates emotions and causes the audience to cease reflecting upon the arguments provided. And as Klemperer says, and Goebbels, of authoritarian National Socialist propaganda, the goal is to fuse the audience into one emotion. And so that's supporting propaganda. Now, I focus less on the mechanisms of supporting propaganda in my book, because when I did write my book, I was assuming that many societies, including my own, had at least an attachment to liberal democratic ideals. So I focused mainly on what I call undermining propaganda. And undermining propaganda is an argument that employs an ideal in the service of a goal that undermines that ideal.
So aside from these examples we started to talk about at the very beginning of our discussion, link in the ideology here too, because you talk about ideology quite a bit in your book and the role of ideology and the types of ideology.
So I'll give you some examples of how, on my account, undermining propaganda and ideology work together. So undermining propaganda only works if there's some ideology there that the hearers have, the desired target audience has, that enables them to not see the tension between the ideal and the goal. So, for example, suppose you thought that immigrants weren't really fit to be fellow citizens. Then you might think that measures used to harshly treat them were in line with justice, were in line with humanism and justice, because you regard immigrants as a class that you have an ideology, an anti-immigrant ideology, that leads you to think that the native-born are the real humans and immigrants are somehow deficient. And so that ideology would allow a politician to be harshly xenophobic, but using the language of humanity and justice, because the target audience would have an ideology that prevented them from seeing that there was a tension between xenophobia and humanism.
Now, you used a phrase in the book, flawed ideology. What specifically makes it flawed?
Here I follow my colleague, the cognitive scientist Dan Kahan, who characterizes ideologies in terms of social identities. My social identity is I'm Jewish. I'm sort of a New York East Coast intellectual. I dress a certain way. I have two small children. I strongly identify as a parent and a family member. These are very powerful features of my social identity. Things that speak to the difficulties of parenting are things that speak to me. I strongly identify, for example, as a father, as a parent. And so I'm going to be political messages that are wrapped in what are familiar to what are in vocabulary that that speaks to my social identity. The difficulty of parenting, you know, the challenges facing families in the modern world, those things are going to speak to me. Those things, that identity is, I'm going to have more strongly. The beliefs, there are certain beliefs that people connect with, say, parenting, with being a parent and strongly identifying as a parent. There are certain beliefs that, to take just an easier example, are certain beliefs that strongly connects with being a East Coast American intellectual or being Jewish. And it's going to be very hard for me to give up those beliefs. It's very hard for me to give up my devotion to my children over, even though I somehow intellectually recognize that all humans, not just my children, have an equal claim on my moral sensibilities. So, no, it's going to be hard for me to give up the theory of Darwin's theory of evolution, even if compelling scientific evidence were given, because it's so connected, even though there's strong rational support for it, there's also a strong emotional connection for me. Similarly, I have a strong identity being a child of two refugees from authoritarianism. I have a strong patriotic identity as an American. And so it's hard for me to see that America doesn't stand for the values I cherish, liberty and equality. And I'm in denial when the United States does very bad things, for example. So a flawed ideology. So we all have ideologies because we all have social identity. So everyone has an ideology. Everyone has beliefs they're more reluctant to give up than other beliefs, not for non-rational reasons. I mean, if you're connected to a group or say a religion or a country, well, giving up some of the beliefs about those that country's virtues is going to separate you from your friends and your social and your community. I mean, if you're raised in my cousins in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family, you know, you will lose your entire community if you give up some of your beliefs. And that's not a rational argument for those beliefs, but it's just an emotional appeal. So we all have ideologies. We all have certain beliefs that we're very reluctant to give up for non-rational reasons, because they connect, because giving them up would mean losing all your friends. Now, a flawed ideology is an ideology that causes you, a flawed ideology is in the first instance relative to a topic, say politics or political decisions. A flawed ideology about, say, immigration is one that where you have certain beliefs that are connected to your social identity that prevent you from recognizing the evidence that's available in reality because of that ideology. And it's flawed because it prevents you from accessing evidence.
So how does that connect then with flawed social structure?
Flawed social structures. So right, I characterize this ideology in terms of belief, but we need to think of ideology as fundamentally material and beliefs as only secondary. Flawed social structures are set up to make you have a flawed ideology, have flawed beliefs, to prevent you from getting the access to the evidence you need about social reality. For example, I lived in Harlem for many years, which is traditionally America's, the capital of African-American culture and Black America. And although I'm in an interracial family, we were quite wealthy, well off. My wife is a doctor. And so we lived in a nice apartment, and it wasn't as, and Harlem is also gentrifying. And it turned out that the path I took from the subway to my very nice apartment building prevented me from seeing what was happening on a lot of streets of Harlem. For example, one day I spit on the ground, and a young man approached me and he said, "Aren't you afraid of being arrested?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "You can't spit. You get a fine." I said, "I don't get a fine," you know, because I'm not, I didn't actually walk on heavily policed streets. I was walking sort of a gentrification path.
And you're white.
And I'm white. Both those features. Exactly. My partner, who's African-American, was stopped once and given for changing lanes and given an extremely harsh ticket, like up to 6 months in prison for reckless driving, cutting someone off. And she went to court, and all she had to pay was a $500 fine or a $250 fine to get it cleaned off. So if you have access to money and you're, you can sort of escape America's structural injustice. But what she noted is that even in Manhattan, that bastion of liberalism, everyone else in traffic court was African-American or Hispanic.
How does propaganda in a liberal democratic state differ from, say, propaganda in a more authoritarian, totalitarian state?
Excellent and very prescient question right now. As I say in my book, the difficulty, there's sort of reverse difficulties. In an authoritarian state, the problem with propaganda is that people don't believe it. People don't believe when the leaders say things, people don't believe that they're going to go through on what they say because they say it's just propaganda. And you find this repeatedly throughout the literature on authoritarianism. Viktor Klemperer, in The Language of the Third Reich, has a whole chapter on this where he talks about how no one would believe that Hitler was really anti-Semitic. And my grandmother wrote one of the first Holocaust memoirs in the English language called The Unforgotten, which is a very important book to read right now, sadly out of print. And she talks again and again about this. She didn't leave Germany until August 1939. And she talks about a kind of refusal to believe that National Socialists were serious. And there was a period in time in Nazi Germany when there were parties, where my grandmother speaks of this, where she's at parties with Gestapo officers and SS officers who are like, well, we don't mean you. Come on. So in authoritarian societies, people just dismiss what's said. In liberal democratic societies, people don't believe there's propaganda. So they don't believe leaders can be lying or misleading. And so what I think you're seeing now is a blurring together, you sort of, as people employ authoritarian tactics in liberal democratic society, you're finding people saying, oh, come on, that's just propaganda. Whereas earlier, they would have either said, oh, they're wrong, or they must know something. The propaganda of liberal democratic societies is that there's no propaganda. And what happens in authoritarian societies is that people too willingly dismiss it as mere propaganda. And most importantly, in authoritarian propaganda, you invent reality. And I don't really discuss this in my book, and I've tried to make up for it in my subsequent newspaper articles. But in an authoritarian society, the authoritarian leader demonstrates their power by creating reality. In an authoritarian society, the main principle is power. In a liberal democratic society, the main principles are equal respect and truth, which work together. So in an authoritarian society, what happens is that the leader wants to strengthen certain ideologies. So the leader demonstrates the leader's power by simply strengthening, making up reality to strengthen the flawed ideologies people already have. So they might say, there's a wave of violent crime. Or they might say, immigration poses a fundamental threat to our freedoms. Or they might give example, they might invent the reality that will lead people to strengthen the ideology that they're already susceptible to. So in the United States election, we saw repeated claims that American cities were in flames and there was the highest crime rates ever, even though we're close to historic lows in crime. And that was an invention of reality to strengthen an ideology. And in authoritarian societies, people like power. People admire powerful leaders. So a leader demonstrates their power by inventing reality. In a liberal democratic society, there are strong norms to punish anyone who clearly violates, who says false things. And you know that liberal democratic values are crumbling when you see politicians being rewarded for inventing reality rather than being punished.
This is partly why you argue that propaganda threatens liberal democracies.
Yes, propaganda is a terrible threat to liberal democracies, but it can also be what's required to help liberal democracies. Propaganda can be used as a weapon to restore democratic ideals. For example, it can be directed against bad ideals. And this is what I discuss in my book under the label of civic rhetoric. Civic rhetoric, I'm very much devoted to the ideals of liberty and equality, and I might try to restore those goals, as Du Bois argues in his 1926 paper, Criteria of Negro Art. I might restore those ideals by focusing on flawed ideals and showing how they're in tension with freedom and equality. So Du Bois calls for artists to appeal to white audiences with negative images, with the sort of images, dehumanizing images of Black American citizens as mere dancers, people who dance and joke. But then within that paradigm, draw them into the theater that way, but then explode those negative ideals, undermine those negative ideals by showing the humanity of some of our fellow citizens who have been unfairly caricatured. And you can see this happening in the early 1990s with rap and hip hop. That was supposed to, there was a crisis of mass incarceration. There was a crisis of over-policing, a lack of empathy. And you had American citizens, descendants of enslaved Americans, producing music that was attempting to show that people in the situation were human, and they were in fact being subjugated by these harsh, punitive ideologies. But they drew listeners in by, quote unquote, glorifying violence.
One of the things about this particular issue that you wrote about in the preface of the book, when you were talking about mass incarceration, what struck me was your discussion about how this robs potential, the ideology of this, the propaganda of this, the false beliefs about this. Can you elaborate on that a bit, on the human potential aspect of this?
For the case of mass incarceration?
Sure. And if you want to connect that to the wider structures of society.
Yeah, I mean, I'm deeply influenced. I stand on the shoulders of feminist theorists and Black American theorists whose work I employ, and particularly scholars of American mass incarceration. So I'm teaching, for example, Elizabeth Hinton's book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, to the War on Drugs, which is an account of the Nixon administration's propaganda that created a system that incarcerates somewhere between 2.2 million and 2.5 million people in its prisons, both federal, state, and local. Our incarceration rate is 752 per 100,000, which dwarfs any other nations in the world. Russia is second at 500 some out of 100,000. And the next liberal democracy is the UK at 150 or 149 per 100,000. So our incarceration rate is staggeringly high. And we have eight times the rate that we did in 1973. In 1973, we had 300,000 people in prison, jail, or federal prison. Now we have between 2 and 2.5 million and 8 million people on probation or parole. So what happened was, in the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement. And the civil rights movement involved a lot of protests. And some of that protest turned violent, like in Detroit, famously. And what Nixon did when he took office is he changed the narrative from social justice and equal rights to law and order. And he repainted and redescribed the protests as riots. So, and we find the same thing happening today, by the way. If you look at Fox News and their descriptions of what happened in Baltimore, a city that was racked by protests over police malfeasance, police misconduct, you see Fox News describes the protests as riots, use the word riot seven words out of 1,000 in its reports about Baltimore. And they used protest less than three words out of 1,000. CNN was more even-handed. They used the word riot just under four words per 100 per 1,000, and the word protest just over three words and per 1,000 in describing Baltimore. And MSNBC used protests slightly more than riot in describing what was happening in Baltimore. This is why I said that you can't define propaganda as, you know, skewed discourse, because each word carries this way of skewing reality. I mean, there were people and they were gathering and they were doing things, but how you describe it is going to really affect the uptake. So Nixon redescribed what was happening, not as protests, but as riots, and then shifted the nation's attention from the ideals of equality and social justice to law and order. And then he applied law and order in a way that undermined law and order, because he applied it unequally, where it fell particularly harshly on Black Americans and political dissidents.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful interview.
Jason Stanley is professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of three books, Knowledge and Practical Interests, Know How, and How Propaganda Works.
This is part one of a two-part discussion. Part two will air next week.
When we come back, the silencing of science and its effects. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What can scientists do in the face of their science being silenced? With us is Sean Hendy, professor of physics at the University of Auckland and director of Te Punaha Matatini, a New Zealand center of research excellence focused on the study of complex systems and networks. Sean Hendy is also the author of Silencing Science. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Sean Hendy. It's great to have you here with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here today.
So there are two roles that you've been playing. One is as a physicist. One is as a science communication person. I thought we should start with your physics. You do nanotechnology.
Sure. Yeah.
How can a non-scientist understand that?
Well, you know, we're all carrying around bits of nanotechnology these days in our pockets, right? I mean, our cell phones have nanotechnology in them. I mean, what's been going on over the last 50 years since we, you know, invented the transistor is they've been getting smaller and smaller. And so eventually they got down, you know, about 10, 20 years ago to where we were really working at the nanoscale. A nanometer is a billionth of a meter. And if you want to sort of measure a nanometer in terms of the diameter of atoms, it's about maybe depends on the size of the atom, but about 10, roughly speaking. So when you're doing nanotechnology, you're almost thinking about manipulating individual atoms. So it's work at that scale. What I do is theory and computer simulation. So I'm a theoretical physicist. And I use computers to try and help understand, you know, how things behave when they're that small. I mean, it's hard to see, right? You can't see what's going on at that scale. You can't see an atom directly. So computer simulation can actually be a really useful tool to help people understand the physics down at that scale. So I'm really interested in how small collections of atoms are behaving. And actually these days I've extended that to people. So it turns out some of the models we use to look at how atoms behave are also in some circumstances work for people. One of the projects I got involved with this year was which side of the footpath do you walk on? And it turns out different parts of the world walk on different sides of the footpath, right? So you were just telling me you came back from the States and you were probably bumping into people when you first got there, right? Because Americans tend to walk on the right of the footpath and Kiwis walk on the left. And your first thought is maybe this has got something to do with the side of the road that you drive on. But actually people in the UK walk on the right and drive on the left. And in Japan, there are different cities that do it different ways, which causes the railway corporations a lot of stress when people arrive from different cities at the railway stations.
How does this relate to the nanoparticles?
Yeah, so it turns out atoms can do something similar. This is a bit like magnetism, actually, it turns out. So magnetism, you know, you have a north and a south pole. And what's happening with a north and a south pole of a magnet is that the atoms are either walking on the left or, in other words, pointing to the north or pointing to the south. What's called their spin or angular momentum. And so they have to make a collective decision, a bit like we do. So when we're walking down the street, if you know which way a person's going to pass you, if you know they're going to pass you on the left, then you'll pass them on the left and you don't get into that embarrassing shuffle. And actually, atoms are doing the same thing. They're experiencing forces from neighbouring atoms that make them prefer to point in the same direction.
I didn't expect to have this part of the conversation with you, but since you're explaining it in this way, something that I have been thinking about, I study mass media and political behavior. And one of the things I have often said to people is that, you know, information is what tells us how to organize, sort of like DNA helps our bodies and our system, how it organizes. And mass media sort of provides that function for people to know how to organize. Yeah. What are the cultures and the mores and what's appropriate and what's legal and, you know, what's good and what's bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sounds like you're saying this is true even on the subatomic level.
Yeah. I mean, atoms aren't anticipating what other atoms are going to do, but they do feel the forces from other atoms. And so there's a lot of analogies that we can use, at least in the mathematics. And you know, there'd be some people who thought I was stretching the analogy a little bit too far, but actually it turns out that the mathematics that we use to model things at the nanoscale can be really useful. And understanding how people behave, which is really, really cool.
Well, your other hat that you wear pertains to the role of science in society.
That's right.
And one of the things that is very clear in today's age is that scientists and science itself are facing a lot of challenges. And you've written this book, Silencing Science. And you've looked at it primarily from the New Zealand perspective, but obviously we're dealing with this on a global scale. Maybe we should start talking about some of these places in which science is being challenged and why it's being challenged. You opened with Fukushima in this book and about how the science was pretty clear that there were some precautions that could have been taken.
Yep, that's right.
Government was warned, actually. It could have heeded the science, but it didn't. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I mean, so Fukushima, that was the after the big, very large earthquake that Japan experienced a few years ago. You know, that earthquake triggered a tsunami, and that tsunami damaged the Fukushima nuclear reactors. I think there were four at the power plant, and those reactors melted down and are still in that melted down condition today. And, you know, we've essentially just got to wait for the radioactivity to decay, and that's going to be hundreds of years. So it was a big disaster, led to massive evacuation of people, and, of course, will have led to an increase in cancer in people. So it was not a great thing to happen to any country. And yet, as people have subsequently learnt, scientists were aware of the tsunami risks that those power plants faced. In fact, there was a really scarily high chance of a tsunami of that size hitting those power plants during their lifetime. And scientists had tried to warn the government, but those concerns had been dismissed. There was, you know, a number of reasons that would have perhaps undermined trust in the nuclear industry. Of course, Japan's very reliant on nuclear power. And when scientists start questioning the safety of nuclear power, that, you know, government officials and the nuclear industry would start to be concerned, right, that the public are being made aware of these things. And so there was a very definite effort to sideline these risks and, I guess, you know, take chances with the public safety.
The public ends up bearing the cost and in some really awful ways. So there are obvious parallels in multiple other areas in which the science is pretty clear, and some of them are more complicated, some of them are more direct, but we're dealing with issues of public health. Climate change is obviously one of them, water safety, global access to water, all of these sorts of things, but they're also complicated.
Yeah.
Tell us about these complications.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, things like earthquakes, you know, we can't tell you the day or the place or the time precisely. You know, as scientists, what we learn about are probabilities and chances of these events happening. You know, we know that over 10,000 years or 100,000 years, there are going to be so many earthquakes of a certain magnitude on a particular fault line, but we can't say exactly when. And so, you know, when we're warning the public, when we're warning government, we're warning them in terms of probabilities and risks. And that's often, you know, if you're a official or an industry, someone who's working in industry, and we're saying, look, in the next 50 years, there's a serious risk of this earthquake, and your career is maybe going to only be 10 years, your responsibility is not going to be for that 50-year time period. There's a tendency to think it's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen on my watch. And I think it's easy then to dismiss the science, or perhaps see the scientists as alarmists. You know, that sounds like a low risk, and why are these scientists fanning fears of the public, you know, when really, you know, it's not going to happen on my watch, and it's just creating problems for me. So yeah, so the complexity, the types of information that science offers, you know, we don't speak in terms of certainty as scientists. That is a challenge, right? And it's a challenge for us to communicate it, and it's a challenge then for the people we're trying to communicate with to understand what we mean.
Simultaneously, what seems to be happening in the economic, political, social sphere is that increasingly science is under attack from industry. And that's certainly the case in the United States. I mean, the president-elect has announced he's appointing anti-science people to some of the highest positions in the U.S. government. And particularly the Exxon head was among the leaders of science smearing.
Yeah.
What can be done in this case among scientists?
Yeah, it's really, you know, I think you're really facing difficult challenges, right? And, you know, as a scientist, are you going to try and engage or work with these people who maybe have very different political views from you, who are maybe going to try and undermine you in ways that could damage your career? That's a really difficult choice. And I know there are some scientists in the US who are just kind of preparing to shut up shop and go into hibernation in the hope that, you know, science will get through this period. And there are others that are sort of saying, look, we've got to engage. We've got to talk to these people. We know that they're coming from a position of anti-science in a way. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, the oil industry, because they rely on science so much, right? They use science. They use it where it suits them, and yet they're very, very skeptical about science that suggests that what they're doing is not a great idea. So it's often the case that we're not anti-science completely. You know, it's hard to find people who are really anti-science. What happens is people pick and choose the science they want, and that's I think really dangerous, and it's something that scientists have to get better at explaining to people. You can't just pick one piece of science and dismiss the bits you don't like. You know, and that's actually a challenge
for
all of us.
That is anti-science.
It's being an anti-scientist, yeah, as cherry picking. You know, and in some ways we're all prone to doing that. I mean, I think that's a difficult thing
of scientific research itself is because it actually puts that under scrutiny and makes the results pass a lot of tests before they can actually be called scientific knowledge.
Yeah, that's right. And science is one of our best institutions for kind of dealing with the fact that we all like to hear the things we want to hear, right? We all want to hear news or have information that reinforces our beliefs about the world. We don't like information that challenges our beliefs, you know, about
or that
the
will harm the profits of a corporation like Exxon or something like that. I think that what that leads to question also on a global scale is it seems like increasingly science is being funded by private sources, often corporations, but sometimes it's also a sort of public-private thing where it's government and private industry together, and there's some really fascinating examples of this. What are the ethical challenges there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're still learning how to deal with some of the ethical challenges, but, you know, some of the things that can come up, right, when you've received funding from private sources is, or even the government as well, right, this can happen with government funding, is that you know, you'll be, if the results aren't favorable to the funder, you may be discouraged from publishing. And that's a real problem for science. If negative results aren't published, that can lead to, you know, when we look right across science, that can lead to a bias in the scientific literature. And it means that other scientists can come to the wrong conclusions because you haven't published your work. Because that, you know, if you've got a mix of just by chance you're getting results that are giving you false positives, if the negatives aren't being published, those false positives can win out, and we can be led down the wrong path, and that can lead to harm, very real harm for people.
And that's partly because science is built upon science. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So you know, often when we're studying an effect, we're looking for maybe a small effect, and this is, you know, you everybody are familiar with the newspaper headlines, you know, drinking coffee is good for you, and then the next day drinking coffee is bad for you. And actually, what's going on is there's a very small effect of drinking coffee. It could be slightly harmful, it could be slightly beneficial, but there's lots of people out there trying to study it, and so just by chance we're getting studies that say it's good, and some that say it's not so good, and so we can only really tell what's going on by averaging over, right? By looking at all these different studies and coming to a conclusion, because each individual study doesn't have the statistical power, doesn't have the number of subjects and the number of people in it to really make it to lead to a firm conclusion. So we need all those studies, and if we only ever publish the studies that say coffee is bad, then science will come to the conclusion that coffee is bad when other scientists look at the literature, if we're not publishing the positive results as well, or vice versa. If we don't publish the negative results, then we might lead to, you know, we'll just reinforce our caffeine habit. And I drink a lot of coffee. I always want to read the articles that say coffee is good. you know, so even then I'm getting a biased picture of the world because I'm preferentially choosing to read the things that are going to make me feel good.
But this is part of what you talk about in your book, is that policymakers do this in a way that can be very harmful to the public. Give us some examples of that.
So, I mean, some of the big examples, and a particular example in New Zealand has been around folate reinforcement in bread. So folic acid is one of the nutrients that, you know, we need, in particular pregnant women need it. And we know that if you've got a folate deficiency in your diet, there's a greater risk of babies developing defects, neural defects, and having problems in later life. And so, as a public health initiative, right, you can mandate folate fortification in bread, and a number of countries have done this around the world. And it costs the bread makers slightly more. It makes the bread slightly more expensive. So there is a downside to it, but it means that women who don't realise they're pregnant and so aren't in a position to start taking folate supplements are getting folate early in their pregnancy, and that reduces the harm to babies. Now, if you're in the grocery business, if you're selling bread, if you're making bread, you really don't want to make your bread more expensive, right? It's going to lower your profits. It's going to lower the volume of bread that you're going to sell. And so you'd rather not do this. So you'd rather focus on the studies that perhaps say this is harmful, right? Because, you know, there are a few studies out there that suggest maybe there are some risks to people from having folate in their bread. And so early on, before it was really clear, you know, people were focusing on those negative studies and saying, no, it's too risky, and picking on those and not thinking about the benefits.
And so for policymakers, how can they sort through this kind of morass of data and studies to try to come up with the best for the public?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard, and even scientists struggle to do this, but we do have to come up with mechanisms and ways. So one way that a policymaker can work in New Zealand is they can ask the Royal Society to come up with a report that basically summarises the state of play. You know, what is the evidence around this? That can be effective, but again, if it's a politically contested area, if you've got a lobby group that's not going to like the results, they'll often, in the media, they'll try and undermine what the Royal Society is doing. The Royal Society tends to be a very cautious organisation. It tries to stay back.
Is that partly because it is funded by government and doesn't want to offend?
Yep, Yep, that's part of it, and it, it likes to be seen as not playing politics.
Not
right?
playing politics.
It won't get into the, it won't get into these battles with these organisations, and so if you've got an organisation that's just putting out information, and is not prepared to engage politically with it, it's just sort of handing over the information, saying, okay, here, we've done our work. It's now your job as a policymaker to sort it all out. Well, that, you know, that can work sometimes, but when politics are involved, when there are there are politicians who are not going to like it, or lobby groups that are not going to like it, then that can be very ineffective.
Yeah, we saw a really big example of this also with climate change.
Yeah,
with what they called Climate Gate, which was yep. the hacking of the emails of the scientists,
yep.
and then essentially labeling the scientists and the science itself as fraudulent.
Yeah.
And it really created a problem with the public understanding of what's going on with science.
The more closed we are as a scientific community, the less we're doing our work in open, and the more reluctant we are to go out and engage with the public, the less trust I think we get. And then we're vulnerable to that. You know, I mean, we all use words like tricks or, let's apply this trick. I mean, that's theoretical physicists love to talk about mathematical tricks. It's not a trick as you might use it when, you know, we're not doing magic, right? It's just a cool little mathematical technique that we might be using, and it's cute to call them tricks. But when we saw the ClimateGate emails and we saw these scientists talking about tricks,
mm-hmm. how it can be misused,
yeah,
or misunderstood.
Then suddenly that looked pretty dodgy. So what we're doing is visible to the public and they have an opportunity to see how we talk and think, then we're always vulnerable to be undermined in those ways.
You know, I noticed you cited Naomi Oreskes in her book in here, and we've had her on the program a few times. She's fabulous. In her book, she talked about a concerted effort among these lobby groups, ranging from, you know, the cigarette industry to the oil industry, really trying to distort these findings in this way. Now, these multinational corporations have a lot of money.
Mm.
And scientists are at the behest of sometimes the corporations themselves,
yep.
but
yep.
often, you know, other types of foundations and grants and this sort of a thing. Is there really any possibility of helping the public understand these issues in a game that's so tilted?
Yeah, I mean, when you put it that way, it's kind of depressing, isn't it, right? The sort of PR resources that these big corporates have. And we do know that some of that is being deployed in New Zealand, right? We saw from the Dirty Politics saga that actually, you know, that there is money from big corporates flowing into our PR scene to try and combat science. On the other hand, right, when you look at who the public trusts, scientists still have particularly university scientists, academic scientists, amongst the highest trusted professionals by the public. So we need to use that
and build it,
yeah, and use the fact that I think people do have a trust of scientists, and when scientists do get out and engage and can have in depth conversations with the public, and also seem to be listening to the public too. I mean, I think it is up to us to take public concerns seriously and not just dismiss them. I mean, you know, often we have a tendency to be elitist about it, right? Look, you guys just don't understand. We'll sort it out for you, and then we'll tell you what the answer is, and it'll all be right. I mean, and we still see that from time to time in the way scientists deal with the public. We don't really want to get down and have our science questioned at times.
And there are also simultaneous problems going on. One is pertaining to traditional journalism, and it's balancing when there's really not much to balance. We saw this again with climate change, where the journalists generally would have a climate scientist talk about the science, but then they would so-called balance it, I'm using my air quotes, against somebody from industry. And it gives a misleading perspective to people.
Yeah, that issue, I mean, called false balance, right? When you've got 97% of scientists think A and 3% think B, which is, you know, that's basically how it is in climate change, and that 3% are often not the experts.
And on the payroll of
corporations,
who stand to benefit.
That's right. Then putting the 3% up against the 97% is false balance, right? It's not presenting an accurate picture of the science. And so that's a real problem. I think we have seen the media get a bit more sophisticated about that recently, particularly in New Zealand. A number of our media outlets are no longer doing that. They've understood that. You know, on the other hand, you know, we still need the media to be skeptical of science, right? We don't want a media that just takes everything that we say as rote. It's so important that we have an independent media that can scrutinize science and understand the signs of when science goes wrong, because you know, there are some very public scandals where scientists have gone off the rails and caused a lot of harm. And so we need that skepticism in the media. And of course, you know, the media is struggling, right? The financial models that have supported our media for really a couple of hundred years are now under a lot of pressure. And I know that you know, journalists are often covering multiple beats. I don't think we have any full-time science journalists in New Zealand anymore. And so that's really hard to be doing travel or the environment as well as science, and to, you know, to develop that understanding of how the science community works and to know who to talk to.
Well, that brings up the issue of new media. And I know that you and some of the other scientists around here are at least writing your own blogs about some of the things that you're finding and your colleagues are finding, so that people can try to understand what is coming out of the institution in terms of scientific research. But that can also be a double-edged sword, the new media, as we just saw with the U.S. election.
Yeah.
It, you know, there's a lot of fake news, and people don't have the fact-checking all the time. So in your experience, how do you see new media playing into this?
Yeah, I mean, it is very much a double-edged sword, and it's very challenging. I think we're all going to have to learn to be more skeptical of things we read on the internet, right? I mean, we've always been told, be skeptical of things you read on the internet, and now we really have to exercise that, right? And I'm having to be more actively skeptical of things I read and the things that come up on my Twitter profile, my Twitter feed. I'm filtering them more on the basis of skepticism. And so we do have to, you know, I think we all have to stop just believing everything we read and, you know, look into people's credentials, right? In some ways, we all have to become journalists. We all have to cultivate that skeptical frame of mind and question sources. You know, one thing that the new media is really good at doing is actually linking you to the source material. That's something you can do on a blog that, say, you couldn't do 10 years ago in a newspaper.
So that would be like a link that people can go to the original data.
Yeah. And I think that's something I use, right? If I see something and I'm like, that doesn't sound right, I look for sources and I can click through to sources and see is there a good scientific publication that's underlying that. And that also means that actually scientists, we're going to have to get used to open access publishing, right? Because traditionally, academic material has been published in journals that cost tens of thousands, in some cases, dollars a year to subscribe to, right? So the member of the public, or even anyone outside a university, I talk to some of my colleagues in the Crown Research Institutes or even people in government, and they can't get access to research that was done by New Zealand scientists. You know, isn't that crazy that a public official, a government official, who's funded some research that was done by a New Zealand scientist, then can't get access to that research? That's just crazy. So we do have to change the model of how we publish our work and make sure that it's accessible to people so that it can be, you know, when there's a newspaper article or something online that talks about our work, that people can follow and see the original, our original conclusions. That's often really fascinating. You read a newspaper headline that, you know, coffee is good, coffee is bad, whatever, and you actually go look at the work, and the scientists will be much more cautious about how they're phrasing their conclusions.
Going back to the issue of funding and science and what the U.S. is seeing with the new administration, you know, there was a guest we had on here who was a brand new PhD student out of the politics department, and what she had studied was the public diplomacy efforts of the U.S. to make Mexico bring in GMOs.
Right.
And what she had found was that the State Department was actually working with all these Monsantos and Bayers and funding institutes and research and that sort of a thing in Mexico to try to make it more attractive.
Right.
To bring in the GMO, the modified, onto their farm products and such. Is there a conflict of interest with this sort of a thing that scientists need to be careful about?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's been some very high-profile cases recently where people have got caught out not disclosing interests. You know, they might have had funding. It might have been a small bit of funding from a multinational corporation, but actually that can completely undermine your message and your image as an independent scientist in the media or in the eyes of people who care about that stuff. So yeah, I think scientists, you know, I mean, this is not to say we shouldn't be working with companies. I mean, that's an important way for making sure our research has impact, right? That we do actually work with companies that can turn our ideas into products, right, that might improve people's lives. But at the same time, we have to realize that compromises our independence and be more open and transparent about the funding sources we receive, you know, and be very cautious about making sure that you don't restrict your ability to comment or to talk about something. If your findings are going to be critical of the company or perhaps undermine a position the company's taken or show that a product is not as effective as a company might like, then you've got to be upfront and say that you will go public with that.
How hard is that to get?
It can be hard. It can mean turning down sources of funding that might otherwise be beneficial for your career. You know, so that's the reality. But if you're upfront and the company really wants your science, or the government agency that you're working with really wants your science, then they will agree to that. And again, you know, if companies are not prepared to do that, then again, we have a responsibility to tell the public about that, right? If companies are routinely saying, no, you can't do this work unless you agree to not disclose it for 20 years, then we should be letting the public know about that. I mean, it's often very difficult. You know, we're not scientists, aren't lawyers, right? We'll read these contracts. We won't often be clear. You know, it'll often be put in terms of commercial sensitivity, and that's understandable, right? A company is funding your work; it wants to get some commercial advantage, and so you know there'll be things you have to sign about the commercial sensitivity of your work, you know, around intellectual property and so forth. So we do have to become more sophisticated in the way that we deal with companies, and of course we do have lawyers in our universities and our institutions who can help us navigate through that.
Well, the book again is called Silencing Science, and Sean Hendy is the author. He's with us here now. Thank you so much, Sean Hendy.
Oh, thank you.
Sean Hendy, professor of physics at the University of Auckland and director of Te Punaha Matatini, a New Zealand Centre of Research Excellence, focused on the study of complex systems and networks. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.